Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nygut. When I was a boy growing up in Chicago, the outings that were by far the most magical for me were visits to Riverview Park. Riverview was an old-fashioned amusement park. Wooden roller coasters, a midway with carnival barkers, shooting galleries, a beer garden, and yes, a sideshow featuring attractions like Betty Lou Williams, who was proclaimed as the only four-legged woman in the world. I'd stand outside the building that housed the show and watch the parade of odd people who were brought outside to lure customers in. But even as a young adult, the Riverview Freak Show, because that's what they called it, always frightened me. I never paid to go inside. But they didn't need my money. Sideshows like that one at Riverview and at amusement parks and circuses around the country were a thriving business for as long as the first half of the 20th century. My guest today, author Beth Macy, has just written a new book that illuminates the strange and tragic story of two star attractions of circus freak shows, George and Willie Muse. They were African-American albino brothers, the sons of a poor black family living just outside of Roanoke, Virginia. How they ended up as famous attractions in the circus is the story that Beth tells in Truvine, Two Brothers, A Kidnapping and a Mother's Quest, a true story of the Jim Crow South. Beth Macy, welcome back to Two-Way Street. It's great to have you here.
Oh, it's great to be back, Bill. Thanks for having me again.
I want to point out to our listeners, you were here about 2+ years ago when your first book, Factory Man, was published. And a little later in the show, I want to go back with you and revisit Factory Man, because it tells a story that if a lot of us had been paying maybe closer attention to what you were writing, we wouldn't necessarily have been so surprised by the success of Donald Trump. But we'll get to that later in the show, okay?
Sounds good.
Tell us about, who were George and Willie?
George and Willie Muse were two brothers born on a Virginia tobacco farm in the 1890s, and they had albinism. They had blue eyes and blonde hair, and their skin burned at the first flush of the sun, and they were field hands, basically. And it was a story I heard about when I first moved to Roanoke. And 100 years later, I moved to Roanoke, and people are still talking about the story of these two young brothers who were kidnapped and sold to the circus around 1900.
Yeah, you tell us early in the book in describing them, their world was so blindingly white that they had to squint just to keep from crying. On a clear day, it hurt to open their eyes. And so they were always, you point out later in the book, that meant they were often always looking down, which led people to wonder about their mental capacity and their ability to interact, right?
Yes, and that was actually common with all people of albinism back then. Most were born legally blind, and they had a condition called dancing eyes, where their eyes couldn't quite focus, and people just misinterpreted that as signs of, mental incapacity.
Now, Truvine is not an actual city. It's basically an unincorporated area outside of Roanoke, right?
That's right. It's about 45 minutes south of here, and it's in the southern Piedmont. A lot of tobacco growing, and it's just a cluster of homes. There's a church. There used to be a school. There used to be a factory, but now it's just a very small community with a very active, though older, Baptist church.
In many ways, you tell us that, and it sets the context for George and Willie's lives, it represents the post-emancipation, post-Civil War South and the struggles that blacks had surviving and thriving in the South in those days, yes?
Yes, yes. The world of the sharecropper, where, they would wouldn't complain about their conditions because they might be thrown off the land, and then what would happen to them? So they would often work all season long, and then at the end, the landowner would take their tobacco to nearby Danville to sell it and would be told, oh, we didn't make enough, so we can't pay you this year, or you owe us because we loaned you money for the seed and the fertilizer. So it was really tough, tough life.
Which, by the way, had a lot to do with the dilemma that their mother, Harriet, had in terms of just making a living to support her family, right?
Yes, Yes, absolutely. It was a really tough time. And I tried to bring that world to life. I mean, there's still a lot of people in that community who sharecrop for decades and up until not that long ago, shockingly. And one of them told me she remembered as a girl hearing the story of George and Willie Mews, and she felt sorry for them. But she also thought of the story with a touch of longing. And she said that only in a place like Truvine, for some of us, could the notion of being kidnapped seem almost like an opportunity.
Yeah. So let's talk about their story. You say it's around 1899, hard to pin down exactly because the story of what happened to them, no matter how much detailed research you did, and you did a lot, it's a little bit difficult to get to specifics. But around 1899, they were working in a tobacco field, right?
Right. And that's the story the family had handed down for generations. They were swept up from a tobacco field and by a circus bounty hunter. And that actually was a thing. It did exist. And, you know, nobody knows who really gave them up. Maybe it was a shop owner in nearby Rocky Mount. Maybe it was a member of their own family. But regardless, they did join the sideshow. The earliest I found them in the literature was 1914. So that's much later. And again, the records are so scant for African-American families that we don't even know when they were born exactly. The years are wildly different on different documents. So we know for sure that they're working with a carnival sideshow by 1914, and we know their mother doesn't get them back until 1927. So I can say definitively that they were, you know, exploited, not paid for a period of at least 13 years.
So about how old do you imagine they were when they first started this journey?
Yeah. The family always said little kids. They didn't know for sure. The earliest known photo I have of them is from probably 1914, and they look to be about 11 and 14 in the picture. And it was a real startling picture when I found it kind of halfway through my research, because they just look like, you know, like deer in the headlights. They look very scared, and they're wearing these suits that I just thought they looked scared. But I sent a picture to a historic costume expert, and he pointed out that they'd been wearing the suits for at least a couple of years because they were stretched out, the seams were stretched, and they were about two sizes too small. So that's like the earliest proof I have of them as being sideshow workers.
So essentially one day they simply do not come home, according to the story that was told about them forever. And you write this: the world had always been a dangerous place to be black, but it had never occurred to Harriet that some far-off circus promoter would steal her boys, turn them into sideshow freaks, and for decades earn untold riches by enslaving them to his cause.
Yes, yes. And Willie actually named his kidnapper. He was their longtime promoter. He was the one that she had to face off against when she finally did get them back. His name was Candy Shelton. And even that was the story that he told for years. And, you know, I would love to have gotten to interview him, but unfortunately, I was never able because the family wanted to protect him after he retired and lived this long, glorious life, you know, dying in 2001 at the age of 108.
What made them the kind of people who would be an attraction in a sideshow? What was it about them physically?
Yeah, their albinism was the main draw, of course, and that was still a fairly rare sideshow act. The giant would make a lot of money, and the Siamese twins were said to be big money getters, and then maybe the people with albinism next on the pecking order. And George and Willie just sort of stood there in the beginning. And then around 1917, a few years after they had been with this various carnivals, somebody gave him instruments, and Willie later said that it was thought to be a joke that they couldn't play. And of course, you know, they turned that joke on its ear because they were wonderful musicians, and they played the old songs from the 19 teens and 20s and 30s. They played them their whole lives, actually, and they were pop songs. One of the first songs that he always talked about was this World War I anthem about missing home called "It's a Long Way to Tipperary," and And Willie remembered they would play that on the stage early in their years of missing home and missing their mother. Candy Shelton would tell them to quit crying. Your mother is dead. Georgie would sing that song to his younger brother, Willie, as sort of, you know, just a way to combat like the sadness of missing their mother. And music became a really, really important part of their lives. And so that eventually once they were, you know, they realized they have an act too, they would also perform. And they perform on many different instruments. I have lots of photos of them playing, you know, everything from a xylophone to a mandolin and a banjo.
Let's just back up just a second, because when they were taken from their home, when they started in the world of sideshows, they were introduced to a world so totally, totally foreign and alien to anything that they had experienced and that any of us really would understand. And you talk about some of the kinds of people who appeared in these sideshows. And you have a description that I think really sets the tone for just that in your book. You tell us about what it was like. You imagine riding in the circus train across the country. And you have a little section in which you talk about the kind of people who were riding in the car who were part of the sideshow. Do you want to share that with us?
Sure. And the circus, if I could just say a little bit about the circus.
Sure.
First, between 1840 and 1940, the circus was the number one form of entertainment in America. And I think we forget that. It was huge. And, you know, people, instead of going on vacation, they would save their pennies for when the circus would come to town. And it was before TV, radio, films, professional sports were big. And, you know, factory work was coming in and people actually had a little money to spend. And so when the circus came to town, like, it was what you waited for. They said it was the number two day after Christmas Day, Circus Day, in the importance of what went on in American life. And during this time when the brothers joined the circus. And so they would move by train, and they were, you know, when they were with Ringling Brothers in the 1920s, it was a huge outfit. It was like a moving city, and it would move. They would have their shows during the day, and then they would get on the train and they would move at night. So I'll read this description of the way they traveled. I say, picture a single car, usually somewhere near the front of the train, full of human misfits, a bearded lady, a skeleton man, a conjoined twin complaining that she hadn't slept because her sister was tossing and turning all night. The freaks, people called them, in politically incorrect language that fit right in with other offensive circus lingo, which was fine by most of the freaks because, well, they had their own pride of calling too. As the art photographer Diane Arbus once said of sideshow performers, quote, most people go through life dreading they'll have a traumatic experience. Freaks were born with their trauma. They've passed their test in life. They're aristocrats.
As you researched the book and learned more and more about George and Willie, do you think, in fact, that they had passed the test and they were now someplace where they could be comfortable with who they were?
Yeah, I think they were eventually. I think those early years were really hard by all accounts. I think once their mother got them back and they knew she was alive, they knew she could see her, they knew that mostly they were being paid, although the circus would continue to take advantage of them when it could, they really liked being in the circus. They would say, people laughed at us, but we were laughing at them because they were paying money to see us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something you'll hear from other sideshow performers' accounts of their time in the circus. There was sort of a pride of calling, and it was the one place where they felt comfortable because everybody was a little bit different.
You mention in the book that that the brothers were referred to in a 1934 article in the New Yorker about sideshow people. And I pulled that article out of the New Yorker archive. And I think the first sentence really speaks to what we're talking about. The first sentence of that piece is, the freak is usually happy in sideshow life. And then the article goes on to say, in his own family or in his own community, he's an isolated, lonely being. In the circus or carnival, he has the society of others who fail to receive their human birthright. They are at ease with one another. That's really interesting.
Yeah, I think so too. And I also think that once I delved into this world and learned more about it, I realized that after 1927, when everything changed for the brothers, when they did start to have a little bit of agency in their lives, although they were never permitted to go to school, so they didn't learn how to read or write, and it was easy to take advantage of them, that they really did like being with the circus. I'm sure there was some Stockholm syndrome involved there, right? Because it was really the only life they knew. And when they would come home to Roanoke, they would be ogled at and made fun of and mocked. Whereas when they were on the road with the circus, they would be, first of all, like kept out of the view of the public because they would want, you know, to collect those quarters of the mission so you wouldn't just have them running around town or whatever. And they were sort of protected and cared for because you wouldn't want to outwardly harm someone that you were going to exhibit.
Yeah.
So it's just a really complicated thing to get your head around, where their lives were actually better on the circus than they would have been at home with their family. I mean, you can make that argument.
Yeah, but another thing that makes it complicated, as you well know, Beth, is that while they were surrounded by others who were part of the sideshow, it was a diverse lot. I mean, there were certainly fat lady, as they called her, may very well have been a white woman. Other attractions may have been various races and whatever. But the brothers, there was a racist tinge to everything about how they were described in as they were displayed, right?
Yeah. I mean, Barnum's Monkey Men at the beginning, Darwin's Missing Links, you know, it really harkened back to a horribly racist era. And even as you're reading the coverage in The New Yorker and The New York Times of them back in the 20s, I mean, what those papers were doing were reflecting the just given attitude that the black people were subhuman beings. And that's so shocking. We think of The New Yorker as a progressive magazine, which it is today. But back then, when George and Willie re-upped with the circus in 1928, The New Yorker said simply, they went back to the circus because, quote, the fried chicken had given out in Roanoke. And that was just nothing. Newspapers ran syndicated racist cartoons all over the country, not just in the South. We all know about separate bathrooms and separate schools, but as I tried to immerse myself in this world to kind of try to get at this question, was their life better in the circus than it would have been at home? I was just continually surprised by just how hard it was.
You point out that a spiel at a sideshow might describe them as descended from monkeys in the dark continent with Neanderthal heads, caveman bodies, tremendous shocks of hair that stand out on their heads, like the wigs on Raggedy Ann dolls. They were described as Ecuador white savages. And by the way, the hair description is because their hair, really, they grew very, very long dreadlocks. By the way, we're going to post couple of photographs of Willie and George on the Two-Way Street website at gpb.org/TWS so people can see these two men as they appeared while they were part of the show. So that racist tinge. You talk about another famous sideshow performer who was actually lived in a cottage at the Bronx Zoo, right? And he was displayed alongside an orangutan. Is that right?
Yeah. They exhibited inside a cage with orangutan.
Now, what was his name?
His name was Otabenga.
Otabenga.
And he had been kidnapped from the Congo. And this was, I think, 1904. It's in the book. But several African-American ministers in New York really raised a stink, and the New York Times covered it, and they said, I don't know. They actually said editorially, we don't know why people are complaining. He's fine. And again, reflecting that just widespread racist attitude of the day. And the ministers had their way, though, and they finally got him out of those horrible conditions in the zoo, and he landed in Lynchburg, which was just an hour away from here, where he was taken in by a nice family, and yet he was taunted there constantly, too, and he ends up committing suicide in 1916.
Yeah.
He just couldn't handle it.
We've sort of teased our listeners about the real story of George and Willie, but I want to get into it in more detail. We do need to take a break. So Beth Macy, stand by. When we return, we'll continue our conversation based on your book, True Vine. You're listening to Two Way Street.
Ce serait dommage de se dire adieu sur une valse, les yeux dans les yeux, au bal musette qu'on ne trouve qu'à Paris, où nos gambettes s'en mêlent sans un pli. Faudrait tourner au son des canettes.
Welcome back to Two Way Street. If you're just joining us, my guest today is Beth Macy. Her new book is True Vine, Two Brothers, A Kidnapping, and A Mother's Quest, A True Story of the Jim Crow South. It's the story of two African-American albino brothers who became star attractions in circus sideshows around the country. Hey, Beth, before we go any further, in my introduction to the show, I referred to these sideshows as freak shows. And I notice you avoid, it seems to me, using that word. Is that a politically uncomfortable word for you? And should I be hesitant to use that word since, in fact, that's the way they were described?
I think you're okay using it. It makes it. I'll admit it makes me a little uncomfortable.
Yeah, me too.
I think some people were offended by it, and others said, "No, we're freaks," in that pride of calling way, and they claimed it. So you're probably right. When I have a choice, I usually use the word sideshow.
Okay.
So, but up to you.
So let's go back and really talk a bit more about the story of George and Willie. So you became interested in this way back in the early 90s when you moved to Roanoke. The story of how they were kidnapped in those days was popularly told around town, in part to warn children about being careful about the strangers they encountered, right?
Exactly. It was given as a cautionary tale, especially when kids went to the circus or a festival. Their mother would say, "Now you all stick together. You all be careful. You might get kidnapped like George and Willie." Somebody at a reading last week here in Roanoke said, "Oh, I wasn't even allowed to go to the circus."
Yeah. So the story you were told and which tweaked your interest was how this could have happened, that these two boys could have been kidnapped, put into a circus, and taken all over the country, in fact, around into other countries to be part of the circus. But so you began to research this, and the key to your research early on was Nancy Saunders, the great niece of the brothers, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what a character. And I have to say, it was really her that drove my interest in this book, because I was told it's the best story in town, but nobody's been able to tell it. And the reason nobody had been able to tell it is because Nancy, who took care of George and Willie, well, George died in 1971, but Willie lived to be 108 and didn't die until 2001. She wasn't having any of that. She wasn't going to ever let anyone interview him. And many people had asked. And she ran this little soul food restaurant called The Goody Shop in Roanoke, Virginia. And when I was told that it was the best story in town, but nobody's been able to get it, it was clear that, like, you couldn't get the story unless you got past the gatekeeper, which was Nancy. So I very cluelessly, in my young, possibly brash way, went in and said, "Hi, I'm Beth Macy from the Roanoke Times. I'd love to write a story about your famous great uncles." And she said, "You just walked in with your chest stuck out and you thought I was going to give you this story." And I said to myself, "Scratch has met its match." So she was having none of it. She pointed to a sign that a customer had made for her. And it was put on the wall. The sign said, "Sit down and shut up." And literally, like, that was what I was supposed to do with my story request. And so, but there was this wonderful place. I was always the only white person when I went in. And she and her mother and her cousin and her Aunt Martha, they could throw down some soul food. And it was this great place where I decided I would ask her, maybe she'd let me write a feature about her restaurant. And begrudgingly, she did, only because her mother said, oh, Nancy, give her a break. And so I did that, and thinking that she would like that, and then she would let me do the story on George and Willie. So I come back 2 days after my story ran, and she said, thinking I was going to get a big pat on the back, because it was a pretty fun story, if I say so myself. And she said, you know what your story did? It brought out a bunch of crazy white people. And I was like, paying customers. But she was really having none of it. And so I just took her at her word. I mean, when she explained how she had been treated as a little girl, she had been mocked in school, and people would say, which one's Eco, which one's Ico, which was their most common stage names. And she would stomp her little foot and say, they're Mr. George Muse and Mr. Willie Muse. And, you know, some of her first childhood memories are people banging on the door, demanding to see the, quote, savages that eat raw meat. And I didn't really know what I didn't know then. She said, you weren't ready for the story. And I wasn't. But I didn't know that. And I asked her in 2013 if I could write a book about it. She had to take the pulse of the whole family and see what they thought. And she made me wait 6 weeks. And then she called me on Christmas morning after making me wait and said, I made you wait so I could give it to you as a present. You can write the book as long as you remember that no matter what you find, because she knew I'd discover some hard things, some sad things, no matter what you find out, George and Willie came out on top. You have to remember that. And I think, you know, I think they did come out on top, actually.
There's a moving thread, and we're going to talk about how they came out on top, but there's a moving thread that runs through your book, I think. You point out that one of the things that was so terribly important to Nancy Saunders is that she wanted the brothers, her great uncles, to have their dignity restored and to be respected. And there's another a pair of brothers who were part of a sideshow you talk about, Hiram and Barney Davis. And the same thing applied there. When Barney Davis died in 2012, his niece pointed out to people when he was being laid out that he was a real person, not a freak. That she said, Barnum said they were monkey, their hands were monkey-like, they had paws. She pointed out, no, they had real human hands. And she said, I wanted people to see they were real people and not freaks. Wouldn't you have done the same for them? And that thread of restoring humanity to people who had been treated as objects, as freaks, really does run through your book. And it's very moving.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. I really liked that passage when I read about their deaths as well. And she, I remember her saying, I would show her these clips where I just, you know, they were treated like they were imbeciles. And
this is Hiram and Barney now we're talking about.
I would show her the media accounts, which, you know, which I discovered a lot of things have been written about them that I didn't know when I initially wrote about them for the Roanoke Times, because, you know, there's so much more available online archives. And she would say, well, don't make them look like fools. They weren't the way they were described. Think about it. And so, you know, I interviewed doctors, lawyers who deposed them later in life, and they were mentally fine. They just weren't able to go to school. They never learned to read. Willie, who was totally blind at the end of his life, asked Nancy if she'd teach him how to write his name so he wouldn't have to sign with an X. So he learned how to write his name, even though he couldn't see what he was writing. I found that very moving.
So they were separated from their mother, Harriet, for a number of years, as you've pointed out. One of the things that you had to explore in that regard, and I'd like to talk about this briefly before we get to the reunion with their mother, is there are still questions that surround whether, in fact, they actually were kidnapped, right? And that is one of the hardest things when you talk about that you knew you were going to have to confront hard realities that once Nancy told you you could write the story. That was one of the hard realities. Was it possible that Harriet, in fact, was in such desperate need to keep her family going that she made a deal with the circus to get some remuneration for letting them go off, right?
Yes, I found some evidence kind of quarter of the way through the research that indicated that perhaps she had let them go off with a carnival operator. I also found evidence that indicated that she expected them to be brought back. There was a notice taken out in Billboard magazine in late 1914. Mm-hmm. Saying she was looking for them. They were supposed to be returned to her, and she wanted them back. And, of course, we don't know if she really took out that notice or not. That may have been the one of the showmen took off with them and left the other showman in the lurch. She didn't read or write either. And so, you know, you question that. And, you know, Nancy was happy to consider that. But she said at the end, after she read an edited version of the book for fact-checking, she said, "I don't dispute what you found. I know there's evidence that suggests it, but you got to think about the way the family was treated by the racist media of the day. Their point of view was never solicited, not once. They were never interviewed, not even when their story was in the paper, front page, 5 days on end, when she got them back in 1927. And she said, I will never believe that Harriet sold her children, period. All she had was her Christ and her children, and she wouldn't do that. So that's Nancy's point of view. Others have asked, like, well, what do you think, Beth, after you've done all this research? And what I think is, Willie named his kidnapper. He always said he was kidnapped from a tobacco field. And I don't want to be one more person that quashes his voice in the story. So, I have to be respectful, but yet I have to be rigorous too. So I do have to say that there are some documentation bits that suggest that perhaps initially she let them go. So I just have to put the story in the full context of the poverty and what it would have been like to be a single mom with five kids at that time, and let the reader decide.
You talk about the reunion with Harriet. By the time, which takes place, as you just said, at around 1927, it's possible that by this point they may have been gone for as long as 2 decades. Is that right?
It's possible, yeah. As I said, the first time I find them in the media working with carnivals, 1914. They were, and that first picture was 1914, but they had clearly been on the road for a couple of years at that time, judging from the costumes they were wearing. So we know that they were at least apart from their mother for 13 years.
And for all that time, they were told that she was dead. And then the circus, is this still Ringling Brothers at this point, or have they gone to another
circus? Well,
it
wasn't Ringling at the beginning. It was kind of these small fly-by-night carnival outfits, and they were sold from one entity to another, and then eventually they were sold to a circus called Algie Barnes around the late 19-teens, and then he brags in his memoir about selling them to Ringling in 1923. And so at that point, they are among the most elite of freaks, and they are traveling the world with Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey, and that's where they are when she discovers them under a sideshow tent.
Roanoke. The circus is in Roanoke, and she decides...
Yeah, Roanoke had been a big boom town,
yeah,
and it's finally big enough to host the big one.
And Nancy comes, and Harriet decides to go just in case, is that right?
That's right. That's as far as we know. Nancy's mother, Dot, who was born the same year, and Dot was one of the first people that I knew in the family, she said she always remembered Harriet saying it came to her in a dream that her brothers were, or that her sons were in the circus. And so we don't know if that's the truth or not. She didn't read, so it's not like she read the voluminous coverage that the Roanoke Times gave to the circus before it came to town. And maybe somebody told her, maybe she just had a hunch and she went. We do know that African Americans were told where to sit. There wasn't even a place for them in the sideshow. She was kind of taking a risk even going in the tent. And it was one of the few places where segregation broke down because, as I said earlier, the patrons kind of walked from one part of the platform to the next as the performers would do their acts or answer their questions. And so somehow, on October 14th, 1927, she finds her way down to the fairgrounds where there had just been a roaring KKK rally a few months before. And she makes her way up in front of the platform, which would have been almost suicidally bold, I think, given what I then learned about all the police that came out. The managers didn't want to let them go. Ringling traveled with lawyers. They didn't want to let them go. And here's this illiterate black maid in 1927 standing up for them and saying, these are my sons, and I want to bring them home.
The boys, or young men at that point, see her. They're singing, you describe, Tipperary, their standard song, and they look out, and they know that's their mother.
Yeah. It's a story the family has recounted just, you know, for four generations now. Willie, George, the older brother, elbows George, and says, look, Willie, there is our dear old mother. She is not dead. And, you know, and they drop their instruments and come down from the stage and are enveloped by her. And it must have been so moving.
She's actually able to get them out of there, convincing law enforcement, surprisingly enough, at a time when certainly most local law enforcement would not pay much attention to what a black person was saying. She gets
exactly.
them out of there. She gets
yeah.
them out of there. And
astonishing.
And then negotiates. After they've been home with her for, about a year, she then negotiates with the circus so that if they're going to go back, they're going to go back under their terms and her terms, right?
Right. So the day she gets them back, it's a Friday. On Monday, she goes downtown and finds this ambitious, brash, young lawyer named Warren Messick, and he files a lawsuit against the greatest show on earth for their back wages and wins a sizable settlement a few months later. And then he and Harriet negotiate. It was the family says it was the brother's choice to return to the circus. But this time they're supposed to be getting paid. But even then, their manager figured out ways around that. So Ringling would pay them according to the contract. And then their manager would just simply, it was called blow the show. They blow the show and go with another circus and continue pocketing their wages. And by this time, it's the Depression. And what does Harriet Muse do? But she finds another ambitious young white attorney who, Nancy said later, she said, I lost track of how many times she had to take those circus men to court. If she was like that with no education back then, think what she'd be like now. She was bad. She ends up getting them paid for the last 30 years of their career, so that when they retire in 1961, there was a house all bought and paid for them. And it's a nice house. And it's the house that Nancy grows up in.
And
so it really changed the dynamic of the family. It brought them out of poverty. It changed the trajectory of the family, and you can trace it back to this secondary lawsuit that she files in 1936. It's just remarkable.
And in retirement, Willie lives to be an old man. What, about 108 years old when he dies?
Yeah. Of course, we never know exactly when he's born.
Right.
It says on his death certificate he's 108, but you know, it's again just these tracking. Ancestry and genealogy for African-American families is so hard because the recording was so bad and the names were misspelled, perhaps because of illiteracy, perhaps just because of carelessness. And so it was really tough to track. And I was constantly like kind of running what I found by historians. And one finally said, she said, you know, just think about it. If we only wrote the stories of the well-documented people, we'd only tell the stories of really privileged people. She said, you just have to do your best with what you can find with empathy and context to present the story. And so that's what I did. It's an imperfect story. I don't know every single thing that happened to them. I would have loved to know what was going through their minds during those early years on the road, especially. But because they were never interviewed, that's what I'm left with. And so it's really a book about historic erasure as much as it is this yarn about what happened.
Beth Macy, we've got to take another short break. When we come back, I want to conclude our conversation about Truvine. But I want to ask you a little bit about your first book, Factory Man. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll continue with Beth Macy. Welcome back to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. We're talking with Beth Macy, whose new book is Truvine, Two Brothers, a Kidnapping, and a Mother's Quest, a True Story of the Jim Crow South. Beth, let's finish out Truvine quickly. You just said the book is as much as anything else about historic erasure, but it seemed to me there's another element that you leave us to think a lot about, and it's actually something you talk about when you're describing another sideshow attraction, Zip Johnson, who was also being displayed as having been a wild man from West Africa. And you ask a question about him. He was literally sold, I guess, because his parents needed the money. And you ask this: was remuneration worth the early family loss, or was Johnson better off playing the role of Zip? And then you say, how do you measure a life? And I wonder how you answer that question in terms of George and Willie.
Well, I just think it all goes back to that moment in 1927 when their mother gets them back. And then until the end of her life, she really had to stay involved with advocating for them and making sure they got paid, because even after the secondary lawsuit, they still would try to take advantage of them. And at the end of his life, Willie Mews was totally blind, and he was still singing that song, "It's a Long Way to Tipperary." He was still talking about his mother. He would say, "She could have been arrested. She could have been killed." And he would straighten the photograph of her that he kept by his bed, even though he couldn't see it. And it was just this great thing that he couldn't have been prouder of. And I think he was constantly giving her the glory and staying true to his faith. And if you think back to those early times when they were initially on the road, and as many people said, you know, the best that a lot of African Americans had was for the afterlife, the best hope. And this was the last memory of his mother and her great faith that she would bring them home. And I just think it's a wonderful story about faith and family. And I'm hoping that that's what I leave the reader with, this moment under the sideshow tent.
That's Truvine. But let's talk for just a minute about Factory Man. So you wrote this book.
Yeah.
It was published a little more than 2 years ago, I think I'm right in saying, yes?
Mm-hmm. 2014, yeah. July.
And without going into great detail, it essentially is the story of a family, the Bassetts, who were big furniture manufacturers in Virginia. And it's the story about a member of the family who does great battle with the Chinese in his effort to save the furniture business in the United States, to save his factories, to stop being undercut by overseas production. In a very, very simple way, is that a good way to describe it?
Yeah. In 2003, this kind of half crazy, gritty Southern furniture maker files a lawsuit against China from a little town called Galax, Virginia, which is really well known for bluegrass and barbecue, not international trade. And he prevails in his quest to prove that the Chinese are illegally dumping product in our market. And he ends up getting duties assessed, and he is able to funnel that money back into his factory, Vaughn Bassett Furniture, to keep his company alive. But it's still a struggle. It's tough to compete with Asian imports, even with these duties assessed.
And of course, one of the things that your book describes in great detail, and because you are always out in the field, Beth Macy, no matter what you're working on, you drove all over Virginia to see the furniture manufacturing operations, to see the towns where the people who worked in them lived. And of course, those factories and the people who worked there became, in many ways, victims of globalization. You write this: the people, and you're talking now about the trade decimated communities, the people wanted their stories told. Their world was not flat, and they wanted a witness to it. Someone to describe the creeping small town carnage created by acronyms like NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, WTO, the World Trade Organization, all of it forged by faraway people who had never bothered to see the full result of what globalization had wrought. That's the story of Donald Trump's success in connecting with voters and winning the White House.
People were ignored at other people's peril, and they rose up loudly in this election. And I do think Washington and New York and in the urban centers, people forgot about these people who were displaced. And that is a lot of what you saw. I don't think their stories were told. I tried to tell some of them, but there's a lot of anger out there about what happened, and people are still suffering. And what we gave them when they lost their jobs wasn't much. We gave them this program called the Trade Adjustment Assistance, which was totally unworkable in my point of view based on hundreds of interviews I've done. And I talk about this food pantry at the beginning of a factory, man. I still go out there from time to time, and people are still lining up 2 hours before the doors are open, some of them in walkers and canes.
By the way, I'm not suggesting that you were endorsing or supporting. I mean, at the time you wrote this book, Donald Trump wasn't even in our heads as a possible candidate. So I'm not in any way trying to suggest you were endorsing his candidacy or his campaign. But what I am talking about now is, and you write about this in one of your blogs, you saw something that an awful lot of us who are journalists who cover politics missed. You saw those people.
Right, right. And they were good people who were left behind and are still left behind in many respects. And I think that anger and that displacement is what you saw coming out. I mean, I had so many reporters call me leading up to the election wanting to go down and do like Factory Man through the lens of Donald Trump in the election. And, you know, I would pass out my phone numbers. But part of me is thinking, like, you missed the story as it was happening. This has been happening for 20 years. And where were you earlier? But, you know, and I think the media in these smaller places missed it, too.
Mm-hmm.
The media has been so shrunken. And not a, you know, these reporters in the big cities don't have contacts in these rural areas, and the media that does still exist in the rural areas is not likely to criticize the decisions made by the CEOs of the companies that are limping along there or have closed, and just don't have the staff to cover it. So I think a lot of the story just was missed, and so many of us were shocked by the election. But I think that's part of it. I don't think it's all of it, but I think it's part of it.
Beth Macy, we're about out of time. Are you got a new project yet? Are you working on a third book right now? Are you starting to figure it out? Do you want to tell us anything about it or no?
Sure. I'm writing a book about this opioid and heroin epidemic that really came to my attention while I was working on Factory Man. You know, a lot of the crimes in these dying factory towns are related to drug use now. Sadly, And it's a story I've been following several families for, gosh, since 2012. And I'm hoping to illuminate the factors that have led us to have this worst drug epidemic in our history, and what can we do about it?
Well, Beth Macy, it has been just a real pleasure to watch your arc as an author since the first time you came into our studios 2+ years ago to talk about Factory Man. It's great to see the successes you're having, and it's a tribute to the kind of journalist you are. You are relentless in pursuing a story. And the new book, True Vine, Two Brothers, A Kidnapping and a Mother's Quest, A True Story of the Jim Crow South, shows us that relentlessness on every single page. Thanks for being with us, Beth.
You are so kind, Bill. It was great to be here again. I really appreciate it.
That's our show for this week. Remember, if you can't be with us when we're on the air, you can subscribe to the Two-Way Street Podcast at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And our shows are archived on our website at gpb.org/TWS. Our senior producer is the practically perfect Jenny Ammon. And our brand new producer, who comes to us from GPB TV, is the remarkable radio rookie, Lisa Clark. Welcome, Lisa. I'm Bill Nygut. See you again next week for another Two-Way Street.